Well, good evening, everyone. It's nice to be back. I missed last week. This is the third week of our series called What is Zen? It's kind of a warm-up for our practice period that'll be starting quite soon, actually, less than 2 weeks. Practice period is a time when we all together and each individually kind of intensify and strengthen our practice for a period of 8 weeks, and each person can decide what will work given your life circumstances to support your practice. So this is a warm-up. And we've talked in the first two evenings about history of Zen, and last week Michael talked about the practice or practices in Zen, and I want to talk about the teachings tonight. Well, I think we put them in that order because really, not just Zen, but Buddhism on the whole is very much based, it's very pragmatic. It's based more in practice than in doctrine. The Buddha himself said long ago, this is a practice for seeing deeply into the nature of existence, for seeing the truth of suffering in our lives, the cause of suffering, and the way to be free of suffering. And he said, do these practices that I teach you and see if they serve to give you more ease and happiness in your life. And if so, do them. And if they don't, don't. Or question how you're taking them on. So the Buddha was ultimately a pragmatist. So notice that I'm saying teachings rather than doctrines tonight, because we tend to associate the word doctrine with beliefs that one must adhere to, or perhaps a creed, depending what tradition we may have been brought up in. But in Zen, we're urged not to hold on to beliefs, not to get stuck in concepts. Even the concept of enlightenment, what that is, well, you know, because we think we really want that, of course. Or the concept of emptiness. Not to get stuck. And Zen emphasizes wisdom or insight through direct experience. Through direct experience, and sometimes that's not even articulated in words. It's experienced. Our experience of the nature of being, the nature of being alive as a human being, or all existence. Bodhidharma, Michael talked about him the first week. The monk who brought the practice we know as Zen from India to China. Called Zen a special transmission beyond scriptures. Or outside the sutras, not dependent on words or phrases, directly pointing to the human mind, seeing one's nature and attaining Buddhahood. His words are often taken to refer to a transmission from teacher to student. But ultimately, there's nothing that can be transmitted. It's just what is the nature, the Dharma being the nature of being. In a much wider sense, it's a transmission from the world to us, receiving the nature of being from the 10,000 things, the way the world is, showing us that all things are impermanent and that we as a self, a being, and all other beings only exist as beings in a way that we are completely interconnected with all other beings, all other existence. So we could call that no separate self. So through direct experience, we come to understand deeply the truth that everything changes. And the truth that everything is interconnected. By paying close attention to our own experience. And we do that in Zazen, and then we extend that into our daily life. So the practice of Zazen, doing it in this structured way that we do, is just really a skillful means to allow ourselves the time and space to pay attention, to kind of train our minds to pay attention, because our minds so habitually don't pay attention. You may have noticed how our minds like to skitter away from paying attention. But this is a natural, you know, paying attention is actually a natural state. Animals pay attention. Watch a cat. Or watch a little child, you know, completely involved in paying attention. And then deeply at rest. You know, so these are not esoteric states. They're natural to us. They are our birthright. There's our birthright. To be awake. So, I mentioned impermanence and no separate self. These are two of what the Buddha called the three marks of existence or characteristics of existence. And the third is suffering, or dukkha, our constant dissatisfaction with our life, with life, and all the details of life. And so that brings us to the Four Noble Truths. And most of you, I think, have some familiarity with the first truth, the existence of suffering in our lives. The second truth, the cause of suffering, which is our desire, our craving to have what we want and not have what we don't want. The third noble truth, that there is freedom from suffering, or cessation, if it's often called. And the fourth, the way to cessation of suffering, which is the Eightfold Path. So note, not just meditation, but right view, right intention, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So those last two are about how we pay how we pay attention with right mindfulness and right concentration. But it's also how we live, you know, with right action, right speech, and right livelihood, how we manifest our practice, and right view and right intention. That's what we do with our thoughts. So it's not that Zen rejects these fundamental early teachings of the Buddha, and or the many volumes of Buddha sutras and texts that accumulated over the centuries and arrived in China from India. But Zen emphasizes the importance of direct experience through meditation practice, as opposed to scholastic study, or there was a whole school of Buddhism that really focused on observing all the many, many precepts and rules that the monks had to follow in those days. Dogen, who founded our particular school of Zen in Japan, says that reading the sutras without practicing is like receiving a prescription and forgetting to take the medicine. So Zen recognizes that the sutras and the texts are fingers pointing at the moon. They can help to motivate us, they can help to guide us, but being able to read them and quote them is not the same as actually practicing with your whole body, heart, and mind. So we can't mistake the finger for the moon, the clear moon of unobstructed mind. So these early teachings of the Buddha form a kind of foundation for our Zen practice. And then with an additional layer of the Mahayana teachings, and as Michael mentioned, the first night, the Mahayana was kind of a reform movement to make the teachings more relevant to ordinary people's lives. And doing that by emphasizing the bodhisattva path. So the bodhisattva being a being, a person who lives and practices with not just the intention to achieve personal freedom and enlightenment, but knowing that we are completely connected and in a sense can't do that apart from all other beings. And so we practice for and with all beings. And the Mahayana teachings emphasize what are called the paramitas, and many of you have heard of these qualities of the bodhisattva, qualities that a bodhisattva cultivates, which are generosity, patience, morality and ethics, energy, concentration, and wisdom. And then there's another set that has an additional four: skillful means, aspiration, spiritual power, and knowledge. These lists of paramitas existed in early Buddhism, but in Mahayana Buddhism they were kind of highlighted and almost in a complementary way to the Eightfold Path. There are many references to them in Zen texts. Now there's one doctrine that's not emphasized in Zen, and that's reincarnation. While Zen recognizes the truth of karma, of cause and effect, the motivation of achieving a favorable rebirth, which is really strong in Theravada and Tibetan Buddhism, in a sense, is not really so relevant in Zen. It's sort of made irrelevant by the understanding of non-duality, which Zen inherited from certain early Mahayana schools. And according to this view, samsara, which is our world, our everyday world of suffering and difficulty, and nirvana, the world, the state of cessation of suffering, are not separated. They're not separate things. They're right here, and they're sometimes the expression is a hair's breadth deviation, and you can flip from one to the other. You may have experienced that sometimes, right? In the midst of, you think you're in some really ecstatic state, and you can just flip into a state of doubt and misery quite quickly, and vice versa. You can be caught up in a state of great distress, and sometimes we can just let it go, and it's gone. And something can turn, help us turn, and it's something, and it has to do with being fully present and awake. When we can just turn As we frequently chant in the Heart Sutra, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, and thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. So enlightenment is not some kind of perfected state only accessible after countless lifetimes of practice, but it is our fundamental nature. And it gets obscured. It gets obscured by greed, by aversion, by ignorance, and all the many habit patterns we've accumulated over generations of human life. But it's always there. So Dogen describes this non-duality as, he calls it, the unity of practice, realization, and actualization. So practice being our moment-to-moment awareness of body and mind in zazen and in our daily lives. And realization being that freedom that comes with direct experience of the present moment and the boundlessness of that present moment in time and space. And actualization is the wisdom and compassion with which we express our practice in the world. So this approach to practice, realization, and actualization being one, doesn't deny those sudden breakthrough awakening experiences called Kensho or Satori. Have you heard those words? That experience of sudden awakening was what was kind of first described by writers like D.T. Suzuki in the early days of describing Zen to Westerners. And we got all excited about it. Right? Wow, I want one of those. Those experiences do come, sometimes unexpectedly, and they can be touchstones in our practice to open up our narrow views, to remind us that our lives are boundless. But if we try and grab onto them, if we tried to hoard them, we'll be constantly dissatisfied with anything that falls short of those peak experiences. And we may even fall into the trap of thinking that, oh, well, now that I'm enlightened, I'm above all that. I'm above right and wrong. I've transcended duality. And some very well-known teachers have gotten in deep trouble falling into that pitfall. So the emphasis in Soto Zen is more on gradual integration of practice into every aspect of our daily life and the cultivation of those bodhisattva capacities, the paramitas, through our practice. And the image is kind of a steady mountain mist, or maybe a West Coast drizzle. That's how we got our name, mountain rain. You might not think it's sinking in, but if you keep walking, you realize it's soaked in and it permeates your entire life. Another phrase that appears in many Zen texts and stories is a word that's translated as thusness, or just this. You've heard that phrase. Just this moment in time and space, your life, just as it is, just as it manifests right now. Can we live with an open, flexible awareness in that ever-changing flow of just this, just this, just this? It's not easy, is it? You know, we're always jumping ahead, worrying about the meeting tomorrow, or rehashing the conversation last week, Our conditioning is strong and persistent. So that's why we need the Eightfold Path. We need the paramitas. We need our bodhisattva vows and the precepts to kind of shore us up set our compass when we reset our compass when we stumble. Because we do. We stumble over and over again. And we forget. So that's why we also need those strange and pithy questions and answers from the Zen koans to jolt us out of our habitual ruts of thought and behavior. So that's why we're going to spend some time with koans this practice period. So how important is it to read Zen literature? Well, not very important. And perhaps better not to do too much at first. Though some people do a lot of reading before they realize that they actually have to practice. That they have to walk the walk and not just talk the talk. But the Zen literature is rich with imagery and wisdom, even humor. It's also got cultural baggage that we don't necessarily have to adopt. But it can help orient us, it can help nudge us along, it can encourage us, it can open our hearts and minds. So it's something that you can bring up, you know, with a teacher. Is there something maybe that would be helpful for me to read at this stage in my practice, or would it be good for me to just lay all those books down for a little while? Because there's Dharma all around us, and not just in Dharma books. And it's also really good to read and study with others, as we do here sometimes, so we don't get stuck in our own interpretations. And so we can hear different perspectives from lives that are both similar and different to our own. And so our discussion of the text can be rooted in our actual practice. So what are some of the key Zen texts, in case you wanted to explore them? Well, chronologically speaking, and you don't have to be linear about it, but chronologically speaking, it is good to have, at some point, some sense of early Buddhism and how the Dharma is expressed in those early teachings. And then there are the early Mahayana texts, the Diamond Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, the Vimalakirti Sutra, the Lankavatara Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Sutras, of which the Heart Sutra that we chant all the time is a condensation, a one-page condensation. But these are not easy texts, and it really helps to study them together with others. So we usually tackle them in Dharma seminars or in study groups. And then there are all the teachings of the early Chinese masters, Zen masters, Hongzhi, Sherdo. And some of these are if we were to take out our chant book and do a little tour through it, you would see several of the chants that we regularly do come from the early Chinese Zen masters. And they're poems, is really what they are. And we do chant them regularly. Then, of course, there are the collections of koans, and we're going to be looking at one of them, the Gateless Gate, the Gateless Barrier, for this practice period. But again, these aren't books you read straight through. They're better taken in small doses, along with commentaries, both old and new, as we'll do, again, during practice period. And then there are the Japanese Zen masters, Dogen of Soto Zen. And so we bring up Dogen a lot. and Hakuin in Rinzai Zen. Dogen's writing is marvelous, it's difficult, and it's rewarding. And again, helps to tackle it with others and with commentary from contemporary teachers. And then there are wonderful teachings in English by modern day Japanese and Chinese teachers and Western teachers. Michael and I are particularly fond of the books by our first Soto Zen teacher, Shohaku Okumura, who teaches in Bloomington, Indiana now. And his teacher, Uchiyama Roshi, in Japan. So we always recommend those. And of course, the teachings of our Dharma great-grandfather, Shunryu Suzuki, who wrote Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Can't really say he wrote it. He just spoke the Dharma talks, and somebody else did all the editing, and which was apparently hard work, because his English wasn't that great. And now, of course, there are fine teachings available from first, second, and even third generation Western teachers like our own teachers, Oketz Norman Fisher, from whom we stole the title of this What is Zen series. So we'd really recommend his little book, recent book called What is Zen. His writings are accessible and wise and humorous and relevant to our everyday lives. So maybe reverse chronological order is the best way to go. But remember, all those words are fingers pointing at the moon. Remember to let go of them and open to clear, unobstructed awareness. And allow yourself to be surprised by moments of simple, full presence and letting go. So often in those old Zen stories, in the koans, the moment of awakening comes after the monk strives and strives to break through, you know, to have a breakthrough, and then gives up exhausted and lets go and is simply present to the sound of a stone hitting a bamboo trunk or a candle flame being snuffed out at the end of the day before bed or a reflection in the stream. That old, old argument over whether enlightenment is sudden or gradual. In China, they had arguments about it. The northern school and the southern school, the sudden and the gradual school. That has always seemed to me like the psychologists arguing over whether we're cognitive or emotional beings, maintaining their academic stance. And it's always seemed to me ironic that the position could be defended by Zen masters who preach non-duality. Because how could enlightenment be anything but sudden? How could we awaken in any other way but right now, in this moment? And how could it be anything but gradual? Integrated, expressed, actualized over lifetimes and generations, together with and for all beings. So I think that's all I'll say, although that's kind of trying to compress an awful lot in a short time. But that's the intention of these evenings, is just to take some time for once. We don't usually do that, to give a bit of a survey, and then to open the floor and give you a chance to ask questions, because we don't often necessarily do that, just open the floor for questions. So I'm going to turn this recorder off. We're not going to record your questions.